from a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Kraft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler. Singer, songwriter, pianist, and musical experimentalist Vienna Tang has released 4 solo albums and 1 live album, the latter with percussionist Alex Wong. Her 6th album, Ames, is being released this month, and she will play Kent, Ohio on September 28th. More information about that can be found at viennatang.com. I spoke to her recently about her music, about writing, and the joys of graduate school, which she's just completed. Welcome to Kraft, Vienna Tang.
Hello.
You've been experimenting with some new sounds for your upcoming album, Ames. Tell me about writing and performing, for example, the Hymn of Axiom.
Oh, the Hymn of Axiom was an interesting one. I don't always write songs that are so self-confident from the get-go, but this one, pretty much from the moment I had the concept and the first scrap of the melody, it pretty much knew what it wanted to be and knew that it was going to be cool.
Someone is learning the colors of all your sages, the strength thing, and show that you're understood. Here you're known.
I'd been thinking a lot about how completely dependent I am on technology, not only the consumer technology I hold in my hand and walk around with, but how my entire world is basically constructed out of companies that use big data to figure out like how to best, you know, design their products and to serve customers and things like that. And I've given my consent to those companies over and over again without really thinking about what their motivations might be or what they might be using it for. And I think I'm part of that generation that doesn't really mind being spied on, you know, if it's going to, you know, result in, you know, better things being delivered to my doorstep. And I think I wanted to take a moment to really call that into question for myself as much as anyone else. And I think there was something about the notion that we're being watched all the time that, you know, for some of us is oddly comforting. And so that's why I wanted to set it in a sort of religious sounding style of music, because I know a lot of people turn to, you know, religion and spirituality for the sense of knowing that they're not alone and that there's someone who is, you know, looking out for them. And so I wanted to write kind of from that perspective, as though it were this, you know, comforting hymn or psalm or something like that, and gradually reveal that it's actually databases that are talking to you.
This song seems to me, seems to an echo of another song of yours called The Atheist's Christmas Carol. And I don't know if it's just the religious aspect or there's something else about those two that link them in my mind. And I'm wondering if that's something that you wrestle with a lot when you're writing.
Well, I did grow up in a pretty agnostic household. We didn't go to church or have conversations about God or spirituality as much of our, you know, dialogue as a family or a culture. And so I think I came to religion with this very outsider's point of view, this sort of fascination with it. And I think that probably comes across in my songs, because if I were to identify as anything, I guess a secular humanist or, you know, universalist or something like that.
It's the season of grace coming out of the void, where man is saved by a voice in the distance. It's the season of possible miracle cures, where hope is currency and death is not the last unknown.
I don't claim that I know anything about what is real about whether God exists or not, and what kind of form that takes. I just love all the different stories and ideas that human beings have come up with over the centuries. And I think in grappling with that, some of that definitely comes through in music, because so much beautiful music in the world is, you know, comes from a very religious or spiritual place. I think music in a way is the one place where I feel like I can tap into that and touch that in a way that other parts of my life have never had access to.
That's funny, because I've played that song for a couple of friends of mine who are really religious, and she thought it was a fantastically wonderful religious song. and I said, and at that point I declined to give her the name of the song until much later. So I thought, well, you know, she'll find that out later.
Well, ironically, it was a Methodist record producer who actually suggested that I keep the working title, because I had the song and I had, you know, different working titles from it, like Song for Winter, or, you know, it was mostly actually inspired by my mom and my kind of the spirit of the my mom imbues into family and to the holidays in particular. And so I didn't need it to be called The Atheist Christmas Carol. I'm like, well, this is sort of a holiday song for me, even though I don't go to church. And so the producer I was working with, David Henry, who is Methodist and goes to church on Wednesdays and Sundays, I was like, well, I'll change the title, you know, because I don't know about Atheist Christmas Carol. He's like, oh, you should definitely leave it that way.
He's like, really? That's, yeah. I wonder what his motivation is for saying, no, just leave it that way. That's interesting.
Well, his joke, I don't think this was his real reason. He's like, that's going to sell records. That's controversial. That was his joking reason. But I think his real reason, he was like, well, it's intriguing, you know, the idea that there's a Christmas carol written from the point of view of an atheist. Like, some people might take offense at that, but some people might lean in and think like, well, if someone's not religious, like, what do they have to say about Christmas?
Now, you're going to be in Kent, Ohio on September 28th, and this is a return to Kent for you, I think at least the second time.
Yes.
Maybe more. So tell me about what's going to happen at this Kent show. Will you be debuting some new material off Ames?
I'm excited about this tour because we will be debuting some of the songs from Ames, which is a bit of an undertaking because it's a pretty dense and ambitious sounding album sonically. So translating that to a live trio has been a lot of fun. But we also wanted to mix it up. So there will be definitely, you know, electronics and looping and lots of different, you know, effects and layers going on. But we'll also have moments where we strip everything down. It's just the three of us on acoustic instruments singing in harmony. We're hoping to explore the whole spectrum of things that I personally love in a live show, like more intimate moments where you feel like it's just, you know, people in your living room singing to you, and that as well as something much more theatrical and complex.
You are, I think, just now finishing up or have finished a degree at the University of Michigan that you took 3 years off.
I did.
Almost, not completely off. I mean, I think you still did some touring. You did an amazing amount of composing, I think, for someone being in grad school, someone who is in a 12-step program for grad school myself, having finished in 2004 and still having the dissertation nightmares occasionally.
Oh, man. I've heard that a PhD is a traumatic experience, no matter how you slice it.
And in the humanities, it perhaps a futile experience as well. So tell me what impact your master's had on your musical production. Did it lead you in new ways? Because your master's didn't seem to me to be related to music. It's in a very different field.
That's very true. So that fact actually had two really great effects on my relationship with music. One was that I got to step away from music and not make it such a huge part of my identity anymore, because I was now a, you know, sustainability student. I was an MBA and an environmental science student. And I think being able to immerse myself in a completely different world basically brought me back to this very innocent place with music, where I would, you know, procrastinate on homework by writing songs or by playing music. And I was basically doing it for fun and doing it in a way that there was I felt no pressure or expectations for it to be anything. And that's something that I think is the bargain that you strike, that you have to give that away when you do it for a living and you're a professional, because now it has to pay your bills. Now it has to be some kind of, you know, there has to be a bit of a business plan around what you're going to do with music. And there's something beautiful about that, but there's also something that I really needed to do in terms of stepping away from that and kind of rekindling my romantic relationship with music in a way. Mm-hmm. So that was one piece that was really vital. And I think it comes across in the album that I'm having a lot of fun with music now. And I don't really care or need it to do anything or be successful. I just want to make it and have fun with it. And the other piece, actually, which is maybe sounds a little contradictory at first, was that I actually went through some weird emotional struggles when I was in grad school as well, because environmental studies is a strange field where you're absorbing a lot of bad news and then trying to figure out what small things you can do that may not make a difference at all, but hopefully might. That's kind of the mindset you have to like bring into it. And I realized after a while that was really hard for me to figure out, like, how to find your way out of the sense of futility into hopefulness and into, you know, moving forward and trying to contribute to solving problems that seem really insurmountable. And I found that the music that I wanted to listen to in that state was not the kind of the moody, slow piano ballad, contemplative stuff that I tend to write by default. Like, I wanted things that I could dance to. I wanted things that were not escapist, but that kind of, you know, gave me a reason to get up and dance. So that became a big guiding principle for the album too. Whenever I sat down to write something like sort of slow and moody, I immediately thought like, well, this has to go somewhere else if it's going to start here.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because I remember, I think it's on an album, you said that you tend to write slow, pensive songs more than upbeat ones because when you're happy, you're not picking apart an experience, or words to that effect, which I thought of at first as sort of a professional hazard to being a songwriter. But now you're suggesting that there are ways out of that professional hazard, that it's to pick up something even more depressing, environmental studies.
and then desperately need to cling to something optimistic and upbeat. Yeah, that's okay. Certainly one way to do it.
Well, that's good. That sounds like a great experience.
it really was. Yeah, I think the other great part of it was that it, you know, that impatience with kind of slow ballady music definitely drove me to explore different kinds of ways of different ways of writing. So, like, one of the songs in the 99 I wrote while basically stomping around in the shower trying to figure out, like, oh, is this some kind of like rhythm that I can write to?
It seems to me that you've got a strain of some of your songs, like In the 99, City Hall, and No Gringo, that explore really political themes. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about your feeling when you're writing these songs, whether that kind of risk concerns you or whether you're more concerned about, say, musical experimentation. I mean, what is the thing that puts you on edge as an artist that gives you that momentum? Is it something like the politics? Is it something more like musical experimentation? What really energizes you? And maybe it's all those things.
Yeah, that's a great question. It really is all of those things. A lot of it has to do with my figuring out what I'm excited about, like what music bores me and what music excites me, and then trying to figure out, like, well, what is it about these songs that I'm finding compelling? And I think a lot of it does have to do with realizing that some of my favorite artists and songs are the ones who do engage with bigger issues and tricky topics. And sometimes even, you know, write from pretty provocative and controversial points of view, but that's their vocation as storytellers, you know, to try and see things from that point of view. I'm thinking specifically like of, you know, Sufjan Stevens wrote a song about a serial killer and how underneath he can relate to that person. And then Paul Simon has written entire albums that kind of refer to different aspects of global politics. That's the kind of stuff I'm interested in topically and lyrically. But I always come to that challenge with a lot of with a lot of anxiety, because I know that there are many ways to write really bad songs. In a way, it's sort of like trying to navigate that minefield of like avoiding the terrible songs that you could write along the way to try to get at something that actually grapples with something in an intelligent and compelling way.
The way you're describing it reminds me of, maybe this is an actual quote from Michelangelo, who knows, where he said, you make a statue by taking away what wasn't supposed to be there.
Right.
It sort of makes you want to kill him at the same time as you try to grapple with, well, how do you know what's not supposed to be there and how do you take it away in the right way?
Right.
But that's fine. He's Michelangelo. He can get away with saying that. You have recently had a very successful Kickstarter campaign. In this case, you're raising money for a video to accompany one of the new songs. Mm-hmm. So tell me about the ways that you see things like Kickstarter changing the music industry, or maybe its effect on you, when you have the opportunity to raise money in a very different way than what's been out there before. How does that affect you as an artist?
For me, it's incredibly empowering. You know, I'm still trying to wrap my head around the experience of it, because to be honest, like, not all of it has sunk in, really. Mm-hmm. In brief, I feel like I have become a musician throughout my career kind of at the perfect time, because I started you know, releasing music and touring right around the time that people started being able to, like, you know, buy music digitally and to explore it via, like, MP3 downloads or later, you know, on YouTube. And that really accounts for the vast majority of, like, how I make my living at all as a musician, is by people discovering music through these channels and then sharing it with other people. And Kickstarter is basically, crowdfunding is the next level of that, I think. This was my first time trying it, obviously, and I was really blown away by how many people are ready to support artists financially for things that they can get for free. Like, it kind of blows my mind in a really good way. Like, there were people who knew full well that my album would come out on Spotify or they would get it from some BitTorrent place, but they contributed, you know, $10, $50, you know, $100, $200 because they felt like, oh, this is an opportunity for me to show my support for an artist that I really like. And we get to do this thing together. We get some fun rewards and perks and kind of insider updates along the way. And I actually found, for me, I enjoyed working on that Kickstarter campaign more than I've enjoyed working on any, like, promotional campaign that was through a record label or something like that, because it was such an immediate connection with the people who love the music to begin with. I was more than happy to dream up, you know, like, oh, here, I'll do an a cappella cover song and, like, record myself in my bathroom and release it to you guys. And that really, you know, sparked a lot of interest. And so I started getting requests for those cover songs, and then that, you know, led to a whole series of them. And for that stuff to happen, you know, so quickly and in real time as a direct conversation with the people who love the music is amazing. I would sometimes balk before it, like, oh, well, you know, this distribution company or this radio station or promotional thing wants you to do a special cover song as an exclusive for them. Like, I would sometimes drag my feet at doing something like that. But somehow it was an easy thing to do for, you know, 1,000 fans.
Vienna Tang, I thank you very, very much for talking to me today for Craft. And I'm really looking forward to your September 28th concert in Kent, Ohio. And I really hope that we'll be able to have you visit Columbus. I think it's way overdue time for you to visit.
Well, so long as the Buckeyes will forgive me for being a Wolverine, I'm looking forward to that day.
We have no problem with that. So, Vienna Tang, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The songs featured in this podcast in order were Hymn of Axiom, The Atheist Christmas Carol, and In the 99. You can purchase these and tickets to Vienna Tang's shows at www.viennatang.com. For more Craft, visit craftheshow.com. For Craft, this is Doug Dangler. Be creative.